This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. Joining me very shortly, in about 1.5 minutes, is our special guest this week, Mr. Peter Schuck. Peter is the author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. We'll be chatting with Peter momentarily. Also on today's program, I will be talking about what China did this past week and how it will potentially affect you and your money. For those of you that aren't aware, China devalued its currency this past week. As we'll talk about, China may be a little late to the dance because the United States has engaged in quantitative easing, as has Britain, as has Japan, as is now Europe. So are we seeing currency wars? Are we seeing the beginning of trade wars? And does it look like what happened in the early 1930s? And what will it lead to? Very important questions, not only as to how markets and maybe your 401k and IRA will be affected, but how might the country and the world be affected? So I'll be giving you my take on that in the second and fourth segments of today's program. For those of you that would like, we do have information posted at newretirementrules.com if you'd like to attend our class where we talk about retirement planning and what to do with your nest egg from a macroeconomic perspective, looking at what's going on in the world today. I would encourage you to visit the website, newretirementrules.com, to get more information or to register. Also, we've got a couple of free Social Security dinner maximization workshops coming up. That information is posted at socialsecuritydinner.com, socialsecuritydinner.com. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program Peter H. Schuck. He is the Simeon E. Baldwin Professor Emeritus of Law at Yale Law School, where he's held the chair since 1984. He's also served as Deputy Dean. His book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better, is available on Amazon. And Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dennis.
You know, there's some exciting things to talk about your book, too. You mentioned that the book is coming out in paperback. Do you want to give the listeners an update?
Yes. The book's done pretty well, and so the publisher is bringing it out in paperback in later this month. And it's gotten a lot of attention. I was on Jon Stewart, which was a lot of fun. This particularly mindful of that since his last show is going to be, I guess, on Thursday. So it's gotten some attention in that world as well.
Well, I would like to start by maybe having you explain to the listeners the premise of your book, Why Government Fails So Often. What motivated you to write the book?
Well, a few things. First of all, it's very dismaying for somebody who loves his country to see how disaffected our population has become with our federal government, with all governments, but especially with the federal government. Actually, our popular attitudes towards state and local governments are more positive than with Washington. And so I began by wondering why this is the case. And, you know, there are a couple of possibilities, and there are a lot of theories out there. But the one I thought deserved most attention was the hypothesis that government performs poorly. I mean, that's the most straightforward explanation. The population is dismayed about the government because it doesn't do what it's supposed to do very well. And so I thought about why that is. And I didn't want to just get bogged down in the political back and forth, but rather to look at the deeper reasons, the structural reasons that make this not just an occasional problem, but an endemic problem. And why is government so ineffective on so many levels? The book also discusses some of our successes, and there are some, but they're fewer and farther between than one might hope. So I have a chapter on the successes and you know what we can learn from them as to why so many other programs fail. But that's the basic. That was the basic motivation for the book, which is to try to understand in a deep way why government fails as much as it does. And and why this happens repeatedly. It's not simply a Republican administration or a Democratic administration, but in all administrations.
So, Peter, let's talk about some successes. Let's start out on a high note. Give us an example that you talk about in your book as to a success that the federal government has experienced.
Okay, well, there are a couple of them that occurred a long time ago, but they're still of great importance to us. One is the Homestead Act, which nourished the expansion west of our society, and another one was the Morrill Act, M-O-R-I-L-L, not M-O-R-A-L, which was passed. Both of these were enacted during the Lincoln administration, and the Morrill Act established the land-grant college system that so many people have benefited from and continue today. More modern times, the veterans, the GI Bill was, I think, by any measure, a great success. And even more recently than that, the airline deregulation, which was not a new program but actually the elimination of an old program, a regulatory program, and then Social Security, which has eliminated most of poverty among the elderly, and then the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is an excellent way of enabling the working poor to augment their incomes by creating a work incentive for them, so that the more they work, the more they earn, and the larger the subsidy they get from the federal government if they qualify for this Earned Income Tax Credit. And I'll just say parenthetically that many of us who want to see the working poor prosper are much more in favor of expanding the income tax credit than increasing the minimum wage, which I fear is going to reduce low-level jobs and increase the incentives for mechanization of those sorts of jobs.
Well, a lot of information there. If you're just joining us, we're chatting with Peter Schuck, who's the author of the book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. Peter, arguably, I want to go back. I'm glad, incidentally, that you brought up some modern-day successes. If we had to go all the way back to the Lincoln administration, I was going to be extremely depressed. Let's talk about Social Security, because arguably, I think according to the Social Security trustee report, the program is underfunded by between $17 and $8 trillion. Is that really a success?
I think it is a success, but not in terms of what you just said. That is to say, the program was a success and will continue to be a success if its looming insolvency is addressed. And the good news is that there are lots of ways to do that that are relatively palatable, that I think the politicians will eventually come to. It's just that the longer they wait, the better it is for them and the worse it is for the policy, because the changes that are going to be necessary are going to have to be more abrupt and cruder as we approach the date of potential insolvency. But, you know, there are lots of ways to do that. The government should have done it some time ago, and I have no doubt that it will be done. So I don't think Social Security is in any way an example of a failed policy. It's just it has to be updated, and it will be updated. I have no doubt about that. The knock on Social Security really is that some economists believe that Social Security has discouraged people from saving for their own retirement because of the knowledge that Social Security will be there for them. But I think as Social Security has become more worrisome in terms of its future solvency, young people today don't really count on Social Security being there, and I don't think it's affected their work incentives very much and their incentives to save.
Well, we are coming up on the end of this segment. We have about 45 seconds left, which might be just about enough time to share with the listeners what your next project is, Peter.
Well, I'm working on a book that I call Five Hard Issues and How to Think About Them. And this is intended for a general audience people who are not specialists in these subjects but are very concerned about them and interested to know more about them. And the five are affirmative action, poverty, immigration, religious accommodation, and campaign finance. And so each of the book's going to have a chapter on each of those topics, which will, I think, educate curious citizens about, you know, what the fuss is all about.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. We will continue our conversation with Mr. Peter Schuck in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I will continue my conversation with Mr. Peter Schuck when Everything Financial Radio continues. In this segment, I want to talk a bit about a topic that we revisit from time to time here on the program, and we do so in an attempt to educate our listeners. And it's interesting, this past week, there was some stories that were actually printed in several newspapers. These stories were also on a number of news stations, radio news stations, radio talk shows. It had to do with the fact that China is devaluing its currency. And I want to take today's program and talk about that in some detail, because it reminds me of really what happened in the 1930s when world economies started to slow. And it's interesting how, as certain circumstances evolve, and they look a lot like circumstances that existed at some point in the past, that the behavior of humans, in particular politicians and policymakers, is pretty predictable. Now, why do I want to talk about this on today's program? Well, the reason I do is that if we see what the outcome was when a certain policy was pursued at some past point, it's only logical, and history tells us, that if that same policy is pursued again, the outcome will again be similar. Now, here on the Everything Financial Radio program, we talk a lot about economic cycles. And economic cycles tend to repeat themselves over long periods of time because, again, the behavior of collective groups of humans tends to be predictable. We talk about the four economic seasons, and in the interest of time in this segment, I'll just preface my conversation here today by talking about the fact that we believe we are in an economic winter season, and like the winter season that we have every calendar year that follows an autumn season, the economic winter season also follows the economic autumn season. Now, in the interest of simplicity, during an economic autumn season, debt levels in the private sector rise to unsustainable levels, and this usually happens because of easy money policies. If you make it easy for people to borrow money, they borrow money, and when the capacity of the system to handle any more debt or service any more debt is reached, then the debt accumulation trend reverses, and debt has to be purged from the system, which creates certain unpleasant economic conditions. And that's really the winter economic cycle. The winter economic cycle exists so that debt can be purged from the system. Well, one of the symptoms of the winter economic cycle is something called deflation. Technically defined, deflation is a contraction of the money supply. When that happens, you see prices of commodities fall. In fact, we're seeing that today in that the price of many base metals is falling. Oil this past week reached a six-year low. So deflation is a symptom of debt being purged from the system. Another symptom of this is economic contraction. Well, what does economic contraction mean? It means that a country just doesn't produce as many goods and services, and the bottom line is, and how that affects you and all our listeners, would be that there would be fewer jobs, lower trade between countries, and just less business. So everyone is ultimately affected. Now, policy responses. If you don't know what that means, that's just an action taken by a government. Often make things worse. a policy that's put in place that's intended to help often ends up having unintended consequences. And it's interesting when you study history how these policy responses tend to be very much the same in a certain economic circumstance, and the outcome tends to be very much the same, and in our view, very much predictable. Now, a common response to an economic winter season by a government is to attempt to increase trade. In other words, increase sales of the goods and services that your country produces to another country. I mean, it stands to reason that if you can't sell more in your country, it makes sense to try to sell more to others. And it's really important if you're a country over the long term to sell more than you buy or export more than you import. See, if you import more than you export, if you buy more than you sell, you have something known as a trade deficit. That's not good. And if you think about this in terms of cash flow in your household, it's really easy to understand. If you have more money coming in to your household, to your checkbook, than goes out, if there's more income than there are bills, you have a healthy economic situation. The same is true of countries. If you're selling more than you buy, you have a healthy economic situation. On the other hand, if you think about your household and you think about the fact that, wait a minute, I have more going out than is coming in, now you're actually burning through resources to make ends meet. The same is true when a country has a trade deficit. So when you have a winter economic season and you have economies slowing, you have economic contraction, you have governments that now try to put policies in place that will help sell more than they buy. It's that simple. And if you think about what happened back in the 1920s, and when Everything Financial Radio continues, I'll talk about some policy responses that are taking place now that are eerily similar to what we saw in the 20s, and I'll talk to you about what I believe the outcome will likely be. It's actually something that everyone really needs to pay attention to. But at the beginning of the Great Depression, you see that we all know from studying history that the economy tanks. The economy did tank, I should say. So in an attempt to try to fix this, an attempt to try to sell more, an attempt to try to pick up the economy, let's try to make the goods and services that we produce in our country, in this case the United States, more competitive. Well, how do you do that? Well, you can try to make your goods more competitive, or you can make foreign goods less competitive. And one of the ways that you can do that is to tax imports. If you slap a tax on imported goods, that's known as a tariff. And that makes imported goods less competitive. Well, back in June of 1930, at the beginning of the Great Depression, the economy had tanked. The economy was in the process of tanking. And an act called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was passed. And this raised tariffs or taxes on goods that were imported to historically high levels. Now, when you look at what historians' view would be of the Smoot-Hawley Act, essentially, it really made the Great Depression worse. It didn't help. The idea was, let's make our goods more competitive, but ultimately, that's not what happened. Now, ultimately, like happens when a lot of times laws are made, and I'll talk about this more when Everything Financial Radio continues, this was part of a campaign promise made by Herbert Hoover in the 1928 election. He was going to aid the American farmer by raising tariff levels on agricultural products. There was a significant level of overproduction in agriculture, but by the time the bill was passed, not only were agricultural products that were imported taxed or was there a tariff imposed, but special interest groups got a hold of Congress, and the bill raised tariffs not only on agricultural products, but products in all sectors of the economy. That led to a significant decline in trade, and this past week we saw something that looks very much similar to what we saw then. I'll talk about it more when Everything Financial Radio continues. Quick reminder, we do have some educational resources available. Our new retirement rules class resumes in September on the 12th. That's a Saturday. You can get more information at newretirementrules.com. And our Social Security Maximization Dinner Seminar, we've got a couple coming up here in August. You can go to Social Security Dinner Seminar, socialsecuritydinnerseminar.com to get more information. That is socialsecuritydinnerseminar.com. We've got one coming up on August the 18th and again on August the 25th. I'll be back after these words. Stay with me.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting once again today with returning guest Peter Schuck. Peter is the author of the book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. And Peter, in a prior segment, we talked about some of the successes of government in your view. Let's, in this segment, start by talking about some examples of some failures.
Let me get at that by mentioning some different problems, some structural problems, and then give examples of those. So we have a very unique political culture. Our political and constitutional DNA are such that it's very hard for the government to take on ambitious agendas and carry them out effectively. Now, certain elements of that that DNA are the constitutionalism embedded in our society, the restrictions on government, as well as other aspects of the Constitution. And then we're a very decentralized society, and so the federal government really can't control, and this is a good thing, I think, can't really control very much of what is necessary to make a difference at the local level. There's just too much diversity in our society for it to be able to manage with uniform rules. And then we have a constitutional commitment to individual rights, which makes it very hard for the government to adopt these, implement these ambitious programs, because the courts are there to protect individual rights and is constantly going to confound the government's plans. And then we have interest group pluralism, which means that there's just a vast, much larger than any other society, a vast number of interests that insist on being heard and influencing policy, and some are more powerful than others, but it's not just a question of money, it's also a question of their ability to manipulate the media, their ability to make good arguments, and lots of other reasons. But it makes for an extremely complex system. And so there are lots and lots of constraints of this sort on government programs. So you know, give some examples. Take the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade legislation that the government is trying to adopt, and Congress has actually authorized the president to do this. But the number of interests that are negotiating and insisting on protecting their financial interests are such that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to negotiate a deal with other countries. Another example of government failure resulting from the same problem of interest groups being able to exploit the constitutional system to make sure that nothing gets done to change their situation is subsidies to agriculture, which are bloated, no longer speak to an industry that that exists in anywhere near the form that it did when these programs were adopted back in the 30s. So the sugar industry today, for example, enjoys enormous subsidies, which increase the costs of all sorts of food manufacturers. And the cost to consumers, and it serves the interests of a very, very small number of firms who have been able to prevent any change to this policy. lots of examples of that sort of thing.
Well, let me just focus on a couple of these things, Peter, if I could. You mentioned subsidies to agriculture, and it just strikes me as you were talking that some of these subsidies were actually put in place in the 30s, and they still exist. Seems to me that whenever a government does something or creates a program, it's very difficult to get a program eliminated. It seems like new programs are just stacked upon old, ineffective programs. What's your take?
I think that's very, very true. And one of the pleas in my book is for much greater analysis of the effectiveness of programs and who gains and who loses from these programs. So I have a whole chapter on the analysis of cost effectiveness. And a very important finding that I discuss in the book is that the vast majority, some experts have estimated 99% of the money that we spend, the federal government spends each year, has absolutely no evidence of effectiveness to support it. And that estimate comes from the head of the Obama budget office, Peter Orszag, and the top budget official in the George W. Bush administration. So this is a bipartisan problem. Politicians create these programs, but they don't want to justify them in any kind of hard-nosed analytical terms before the program's created, and then after it's created, they just want to go on to something else and pretend that these programs are working. And in a vast number of cases, they're not.
So, Peter, you just mentioned there seems to be consensus on both sides of the aisle that a lot of government spending is ineffective, if not 99%. I think we could say the vast, vast majority and be safe. So if there is this consensus...
Well, the 99% figure is that we don't have any evidence. We've never studied to see it.
Gotcha.
I don't know if 99% is ineffective, but 99% of the programs are not assessed in terms of their effectiveness.
Thank you for that clarification. If there is consensus, if there is agreement that a lot of government spending is ineffective or needs to be studied, why are we not moving ahead to try to resolve some of this ineffectiveness? What's keeping it from getting done?
Well, one of the things is that costs that are imposed by ineffective programs are benefits to somebody. Somebody gains from them. And So they fight hard to maintain these advantages, even though they're very costly to the rest of us. A lot of the tax expenditure programs are highly advantageous to upper middle class and upper class people, and not to middle lower working class people. Who bear most of the burdens of those tax expenditures because they have to pay higher taxes in order to finance them. That's one kind of example of a social cost being of great benefit to a relatively small number of people. A second thing is that these programs often sound good, and we want to believe that they're effective, but they turn out not to be. Head Start's a very good example of this. Everybody wants Head Start to succeed. It costs it's a hugely expensive program at this point after 50 years, we all believe in helping kids learn, and especially if they come from disadvantaged backgrounds. But study after study shows that these programs that the Head Start program does not work. And that by the third grade, any advantages that Head Start students have over those who didn't enter the program, controlling for every other variable, have vanished. It's a really hard problem, but because the program speaks to our deepest hopes for improving the lot of disadvantaged kids, we adopt the program and then don't change it much.
Peter, let me go back in the time we have left. You had mentioned that some of these programs benefit a fairly small group of people. That makes me think of something you brought up earlier, that one of the issues is interest group pluralism. How big a problem are special interest groups in fixing these issues?
Well, it's extremely complicated because what I'm calling special interest groups or interest group pluralism is actually a very good thing from many perspectives. The results can be very perverse, but after all, what it is that people seeking representation of their interests, of what they hope to accomplish, and the values that they have. So, you know, in a democracy, they deserve to be heard. The problem is that some groups have superior advantages politically. And again, I emphasize money is only one of the advantages that they may have. There are many other groups that are relatively poorly funded that have a lot of influence because of some other thing that they have, such as a very mediagenic sponsor or a name like Kennedy or Bush behind them. And so interest group activity is absolutely essential in a democracy, but one would hope that the politicians who have to listen to all their claims, the interest group claims and pressures, would deliberate and would find better ways of harmonizing the conflicting interests in a very complex society. It's a hard job. Being a politician is an extremely hard job, but they could certainly do a better job than they do now, and I explain the variety of reasons why that is and how it could be better.
Well, Peter, we've got about a minute and a half left. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that we're entering another election cycle here. Do you see anything on the horizon with a candidate, with the American mood, that would signal we might be seeing a change that would bring us closer to solutions on some of these issues?
I wish I could, but I don't. And I am a very optimistic person. I'm very bullish on the United States. I think this is the greatest system in the world, as despite its many, many flaws. But the political situation in the country is sharply divided, and we should recall that it's always been sharply divided. This is not new. Some of the impediments to compromise are greater today than they were before. The good news is that the American public seems to be fed up and is demanding change, but only in a fairly inarticulate way. And so candidates can interpret those complaints in many different ways. So I don't see a great deal of progress in the future. What matters most in American society, I think, is how the economy works, and in one sense, this political polarization makes it harder for the government to mess with the economy. And I think, by and large, that's a good thing. So if our economy works well, and our civil society, which consists of all the organizations that do great things in our society, churches and social organizations and so forth, then I think if they continue to do that, I think we'll be in pretty good shape, notwithstanding the government. The trick is to keep the government from doing a lot of harm, and I think the American public is eager to do that.
We're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Peter Schuck. His book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better, coming out in paperback this month on Amazon. Peter, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Dennis.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. And thank you to our special guest this week, Mr. Peter Schuck, for joining us. This week on Everything Financial Radio, we've been talking about the similarities between policy response or government actions taken today versus the 1930s. And we talked about the fact previously on Everything Financial Radio that we are in, we believe, an economic winter season. And an economic winter season follows an economic autumn season. And while there are a lot of characteristics of these that I talked about previously, just to frame the conversation in this segment, let me once again briefly discuss those. In an economic autumn season, debt accumulates to the point that the system cannot handle any more debt. Debt in the system has reached its capacity. In a winter economic season, debt is purged from the system, which has a number of unpleasant economic consequences, deflation being one of them, and that typically means fewer jobs, lower trade, lower pay for those that have jobs, and stocks decline. Now, policy response, as we discussed, can often make matters worse. Now, we talked about in the segment that preceded this that in the 1930s, at the beginning of the Depression, the economy was tanking, and in an effort to try to fix the tanking economy, the government put tariffs in place on imported goods. That's basically a tax on imports. The idea being that if you make foreign goods more expensive, the goods that you manufacture domestically in your own country now become more attractive. Well, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of June of 1930 was put in place, and as the bill was being considered, a number of special interest groups got involved with Congress, not unlike what we see today. And by the time the legislation passed, the bill raised tariffs not only on agricultural products, which was the initial intent, but on all products in all sectors of the economy. Now, this did not help end the Great Depression. In fact, in my view, it caused more suffering because we saw countries affected by these tariffs retaliate. Now, without going through all the blow-by-blow descriptions of all these efforts at retaliation, the bottom line is U.S. imports from Europe declined from a 1929 high of about $1.3 billion to just $390 million in 1932. So in 3 years, let's just say there was almost a 70% decline in U.S. imports from Europe. And U.S. exports fell by about the same margin from $2.3 billion to $784 million over the same time frame. So that's almost a 70% decline in world trade during that time frame. That is significant. So there were some unintended consequences, things that were policy responses that were implemented that made things worse. Now, are we beginning to see a repeat today of the same mistake? I believe that we are. There was an article in USA Today this past week that talked about the fact that China this past week took steps to devalue its currency. I'll give you just a bit from the article. Stocks tumbled and oil hit a six-year low Tuesday after China unexpectedly reduced the value of its currency in an effort to provide a boost to its lagging economy by making goods more affordable to foreign buyers. China reported that its exports fell more than 8% in July. While a weaker yuan, which is the Chinese unit of currency, makes Chinese exporters' products more affordable abroad, it makes U.S. goods exported to China more expensive. That could crimp sales and profits of U.S. companies that do business in China. In short, a weaker yuan makes U.S. products less competitive in China. If the yuan is weaker, it makes Chinese goods that are sold in the United States more attractive. It turns them into a really good deal, and it makes it really tough for the United States exporters that sell goods in China to compete because the dollar is so much stronger than the yuan, the Chinese currency. Now, there's a debate going on in Wall Street saying that is the move by China seen as a sign that the government is concerned about weak growth, and what will that mean when the Federal Reserve looks at raising interest rates, which they're widely expected to do? Now, let me point out that the last two times the Federal Reserve or the FOMC has met, we have predicted they would not raise interest rates. I will again go on record as saying that I don't believe they will raise interest rates again either. And if they do, it will be a quarter point increase, I believe, which is really more symbolic than it is anything else. Now, ultimately, I believe that what's going on worldwide is the beginning of what we saw in the 1930s. We saw tariffs being slapped on imported goods by a number of countries. The result was plunging trade. We're not seeing tariffs this time, but we're seeing currencies being devalued. Now, the Chinese government is trying to make their exports more attractive. Now, where is the Chinese economy? Well, there was an article published by CBC, CBC News, that talked about the fact that the Chinese economy has been underperforming. And Lauren Brand, who's a professor at the University of Toronto's Department of Economics, said that this is a normal course of action. This is that's seen in most weak economies. Their exchange rate adjusts, and it provides a margin with which they can try to help the economy recover. China's economic growth fell to 7.4% in 2014. That's a drop-off from double-digit growth they were experiencing prior to that. The country's manufacturers are seeing their fourth year of price deflation. That is a symptom of debt excesses. Let me just go on record as saying that this will not happen, and in reality, China is kind of coming late to this currency devaluation game, and we expected that they would. Japan began devaluing its yen a couple years ago using quantitative easing similar to what the United States has used. Britain and the European Central Bank have also deployed monetary policies as recently as this spring, aimed at bringing down the value of the pound and the euro as well. So worldwide, we see countries trying to win the export game by devaluing currencies, similar to the way in the 1930s that countries attempted to win it by slapping tariffs or taxes on imported goods. The result, I believe, will be the same unintended consequences that we saw in the 30s. Trade will fall off, stocks will fall, and the economy will suffer. Now, for those of you that would like to learn more, those of you like to know about some additional educational resources that are available, I would invite you to visit the website newretirementrules.com. There on the website, you'll find posted information about our upcoming New Retirement Rules class that will be held on Saturday, September 12. That will be held at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. The cost for the class is just $49. That's a cost for you and a guest, all your handouts, the book, and lunch. Again, all the information's posted at the website, newretirementrules.com. You can register there as well. We also have available a free Social Security Maximization Dinner Workshop that we're doing. We've got a couple of them coming up in August, on August 18 at Stonewater Country Club, August 25 at the Highlands in Grand Rapids. You can get more information by visiting socialsecuritydinner.com. The website, again, is socialsecuritydinner.com. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. We'll be back again next week. Bye.